From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food. Today, we begin with the incredible edible egg.
So, a perfect omelette should be very, very moist. Like you almost don't feel it in your mouth. Like everything should melt, like almost you don't need to bite it, you know, I can say in English, it's just, it's very delicate. It's like almost like to have a very, very soft panna cotta in your mouth. It's really all about the texture of the omelette and not the garnish.
Ludo Lefebvre is known as many things, the progenitor of the pop-up, a television personality, but right now in Los Angeles, the chef owner behind Trois Mecs and Petit Trois is known as a man who makes a perfect, perhaps life-changing omelet. His version, with Boursin cheese and a few chives, has been his favorite since childhood. Hi.
Hi, Heaven. How are you?
Oh, it's so great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I've been really lucky, and I've gotten to have eggs that you've cooked a few times. Once scrambled, that I'll never forget, with uni. And the omelet that you're serving now at Petit Trois. So take me through the ingredients. What do you start with?
So, sure. Bon, I start with a nonstick pan.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So you're not into copper or traditional French pan?
No.
Black steel?
No, just a nonstick pan. Then a little rubber spatula. And the ingredients, so of course, very, very good eggs, good butter, salt, chive, and that's it. That's the omelette. Then after, you can add cheese if you want or some garnish. But I prefer just eggs, salt, herbs, and a little touch of cheese too. Like at Petit Trois, we use Boursin. With Boursin, I would call it like the French Valvida.
Velvita.
Valvita. Because everybody in France have Boursin in their fridge. And, you know, it's a very cheap cheese and it's good. Everybody love it.
Okay, so take us through the process from beginning to end. First of all, the eggs. The eggs should be very fresh.
Very fresh. We get our eggs in the farmer's market, crack the eggs in the mixing bowl, mix them very, very, very energetic.
Energetically.
Energetic, you know, beat them very well. You know, you make sure the egg yolk and the egg white are mixed very well. Sometimes people do a mistake and don't mix enough, and then you see some little piece of egg white in your omelette. So make sure it's really, you whisk them, you beat them a lot, like at least for good 2 or 3 minutes.
Do you do it with a fork or with a whisk?
I do a whisk. But I remember who's giving me a hard time at the restaurant. Anthony Bourdain came to the restaurant and see me beating an omelette with a whisk. Oh, Jacques Pépin, you know, don't use a whisk, Ludo. Jacques Pépin, use a fork.
And Jacques Pépin is the most viewed example of making an omelette on the internet.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. No, seriously?
Yeah.
Amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So anyway, so beat your eggs very well, seasoning a little your eggs with kosher salt and white pepper.
White pepper?
I never really like your black pepper. I don't know. For me, black pepper is too strong, and you see them in the eggs. I don't like it.
Your white pepper, is it fresh ground?
Yeah, fresh ground, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, beat the eggs, kosher salt, white pepper, fresh ground. Then after, melt a little piece of butter in a nonstick pan. I would say take like an 8-inch or 9-inch nonstick pan.
And how many?
Three eggs. Then, melt your butter slowly. No coloration. Okay, I want your butter to sizzling, but no coloration. You know, don't make a brown butter. Your butter should be gentle, like melting slowly. An omelette is the way to cook it, is to need to be gentle. And then, add your eggs, and then just with the spatula, just scramble them. Imagine you scramble eggs with a whisk, do the same thing with the spatula. You almost do like you start from the middle and go around, how you say.
You're almost going around like in a spiral.
Voilà, exactly, you do that. You start the middle, you mix, and go all around until the border and putting back the eggs in the middle. And you do that for at least 2 or 3 minutes. Then your eggs are going to start to set up. So when you see your eggs to set up, you stop on the side of the burner. And then after you have your boursin cheese, put a lot of boursin cheese. I mean, I would say for 3 eggs, put at least a good 2 ounces of boursin cheese in your omelette. Then put it back in on the top of the burner. Let set for 1 minute. And then we're going to start the process to rouler the omelette.
Before we roule the omelette, describe what the surface looks like. Is it wet?
It's a little wet. The eggs are cooked, but it's a little bit wet. A little bit, you know. It's not very cooked through.
So it's glistening.
Glistening, well, exactly. It's like glistening. It's like almost like when you see the ocean, you know, like when it's flat. Very nice, very shiny, and the eggs are cooked. And then you're going to start the process to folding, rouler your omelette. You're going to take your omelette in your hand and lift a little your omelette.
The pan.
The pan. And then with the spatula, you are going to take the top of the omelette and start the folding with the spatula, slowly. But you put too little bit touch of butter.
Oh.
You know, this will make your omelette a little shiny and it'll be more easy for the omelette to not be stick in the non-stick pan to help the folding, the butter, definitely. And I flip it over into the plate. And after you add a little touch of fleur de sel, chopped chive, and voilà.
It's the most incredible combination, that simple omelette with this Dijon dressed
with shallot.
Salad. Yes.
Dijon mustard, white wine vinegar, chopped shallot. And I use canola oil.
Now, some people might say, oh, you're putting a salad on the side of the omelet for breakfast?
Yeah.
So is breakfast when you would typically eat an omelet, or would you eat it another part of the day?
No. In France, we don't really eat an omelet for breakfast. We eat more an omelet maybe for lunch or more the night. Most of the time, I always remember my grandma always was doing an omelet most of the time when she have nothing in the fridge. Because in France, we always have eggs in the fridge. So scrambled eggs, omelette, and cheese and herbs. That's it. So in France, it was more like the night.
Are you having fun with Petit Trois, being able to serve this kind of food?
Yeah, I'm very happy at Petit Trois, you know, to really serve some very, very classic French dish, like a steak frites, omelette. We have steak tartare. Now we're working on choucroute for the winter, on cassoulet. Very classic, you know. Most of the time, I'm known for being more like a more high-end chef, you know, more frou-frou restaurant a little bit, I will say. But I'm so happy to create this little Petit Trois. People really feel like they're in France. It's tiny. Yeah, you're going to touch your neighbor, but that's the way it is in Paris, no little wine bar.
The last time I was there, actually, the neighbors that were eating to the side of me, we shared our food.
See, that's so cool. You know, Evan, that's exactly what I want to create in Petit Trois. I want the food bring people together. And for me, that's very important to create a art of living in this restaurant. It's where we create life, where life happening. My inspiration for this place come from a restaurant in Paris in the 6th arrondissement called L'Avant Comptoir. It's a tiny little restaurant. You have 2 cook and they just do everything. Serving your wine, your cocktail, and people sharing plate, it's small plate. I just love this ambiance. I love it.
Thank you so much, Ludo.
Merci, Evan. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
That was Ludo Lefebvre. His restaurants are Petit Trois, where you can find his delicious boursin omelette, and of course, Trois Mecs. To Americans, the egg is often a humble dish, served up from diner griddles or featured on brunch menus. But as we just heard from Ludo, the French celebrate les œufs, coddling them with patience, the way Americans may fuss over meat in a smoker. Alexandre Lobrano has been living in France, reporting on the dining scene there for years. His books include Hungry for France and Hungry for Paris, now in its second edition. We asked him to join us for a rumination on les œufs. Hi, Alec.
Hi.
The last time we talked, our conversation focused on how French food in France is evolving. And I have to say, the French way with eggs, I kind of hope, doesn't evolve too weirdly, since it seems so perfect as it is?
Well, happily, it's a two-speed story. The things that we all love, the classic egg dishes and the beautiful omelets and other egg preparations that are in so many French cookbooks, are still widely available. But what's happening now, which is brilliant, is the egg has become a preferred ingredient among a new generation of modern French bistro chefs. And this fall in Paris, there are eggs absolutely all over the place. In all the best new restaurants, eggs have a starring role. And they're mostly, they're slow cooked. You know, they put them in like plastic pouches and then they slow cook them so that the yolk is almost has the consistency of custard. And then they build a dish out from that. And I think this has been just a very egg. It's almost like Eastern Paris. There's so many eggs all over the place.
Yeah, it's been like that here in L.A. for a couple of years now. The 63-degree sous vide egg adorning everything. I'm curious to know, in France, are they taking it beyond just adorning something?
Well, the egg, a lot of what's happening now, originally a lot of those dishes were appetizers. So you'd have that, you know, that beautifully cooked organic egg, when it would be garnished with wild mushrooms or, you know, all sorts of different things. Now it's moving into a main course role, and I think it's part of a broader trend in France as people are really very rapidly moving away from having meat and fish as the stars of the main course segment of any menu. Eggs are suddenly crossing over from the appetizer category and showing up as on an equal footing with things that were considered, quote, important in the French kitchen in the past.
So just remind us of how the French would use an egg in an appetizer way in sort of a more classic kitchen.
Well, the one of the most famous French dishes I can't get enough of is œuf en mirette, which is a famous Burgundian dish, and these are coddled eggs that are served in a deeply reduced red wine sauce that's made with shallots and onions and long slivers of bacon that the French call lardon and pearl onions, and the sauce slathers the eggs, and it is, you know, that and a big chunk of baguette is one of the most beautiful things around. Coddled eggs in beds of vegetables show up in many of the regional French kitchens. They're very popular in the south of France. They're popular in Alsace. So, you know, the egg has had a major role in French farmhouse cooking for centuries.
What is a coddled egg?
A coddled egg is, it's almost like a baked egg as opposed to poaching an egg in hot water. You can do it in a bain-marie. In other words, like if you had a Pyrex custard glass or custard cup, you put it in a bath of hot water in the oven, and then you crack the egg directly into the custard cup. And you can add butter, you could add a little olive oil, you could add fresh herbs, you could add other seasoning, and you basically bake the egg in a slow oven.
Mm. Sounds so delicious. I mean, when I think about, first of all, I have to say that those coddled eggs and wine sauce sound totally like a main course to me. It seems inconceivable that one could start with that as an appetizer and then move on.
They're moving into, the French are suddenly, and we have mixed feelings about it because I like brunch, but I don't really want to mash breakfast and lunch together. But œuf en mirette, the Burgundian dish with the red wine, is turning into a popular French brunch dish. But the movement of the egg into a quote, more important category on Paris menus and in the menus in other French cities is really, really, really something that's quite noticeable right now.
Take us through a little tour, though, of some of the classics. How often on restaurant menus do you see savory soufflés?
The soufflé, unfortunately, has gone sort of flat as a trope, a gastronomic trope on French menus because they're very labor intensive, and with the cost pressures on many, most French kitchens now are very leanly staffed, And the lean staffing is because of the exorbitant price of labor in France. So anything that's too time-consuming is being marched off stage. The most famous restaurant for soufflés in Paris, Le Soufflé, on the Rue de Montabaur, right in the heart of Paris, is still there. And they do beautiful soufflés. I mean, classic things like smoked salmon. In the spring, they do a sorrel soufflé, which is absolutely gorgeous. But they take the soufflé in lots of different directions. They use it as sort of a canvas for whatever is best of season at any given moment. So it could be black currants, or it could be different types of nuts. They even make a venison soufflé in season.
So interesting. Tell me your favorite place to have a classic lardon salad.
I like to go to Chez Denis in Les Halles, the all-night bistro, which serves until 5 o'clock in the morning. And it's one of the last places that's left from the days when Les Halles was still Les Halles. And there they do it just the way that they should. I mean, the lardons are hot when they're put on top of the escarole. They use slightly cheap red wine that's sort of biting. Sometimes they use nut oils, but most of the time it's kind of like low-grade olive oil, and it's just unbelievably good. The other thing I'd mention, too, just for fun, is that the other egg situation in Paris is the fish eggs. I mean, just to parse out the egg away from the hen, with salmon and trout eggs and flying fish eggs. And I'm seeing fish eggs, different types of fish eggs, things that I can't immediately identify. So eggs are ruling it right now in France.
The circular world.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Alec.
I always enjoy it, Evan.
That was Alexandre Lebrano, author of both Hungry for France and Hungry for Paris, now in its second edition. Alec will be at L'Assiette on Melrose for a steak frites dinner and book signing. We've got details on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, we're going to stick with France for a little longer. Expect floating islands and cassoulet. Next.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. Usually, when we talk about Chez Panisse and the California food revolution, we talk about American chefs inspired by France. Yet my next guests were quite the opposite. Two French expats who landed in Berkeley, met outside Chez Panisse, and married 6 months later. Their 3-decade-plus marriage is filled with a zest for life, rooted in France, yet played out against the freedom of California. Jean-Pierre Moulet spent decades as the executive chef at Chez Panisse. His wife, Denise Lurton Moulet, was a wine importer. Together, they co-authored French Roots, part cookbook and part memoir. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so glad to have the two of you here. I'm fascinated by so many things about your story. I would love for you to each share a bit of your background with us. If you could each let us know, what part of France are you from?
I grew up in Bordeaux, in the wine country, because my family has been making wine for 5 generations. And so I grew up in the vineyards. But after the war, you could not live on making wine. You had to have several crops. So my family was having corn and wheat and clover and wine. And Bordeaux became really full of vineyards more like in the late 70s and the 80s. When I grew up in the 50s and 60s, the landscape was very different. You had vineyards and other crops. And I was sent to boarding school at 8. And after that, I went to university. I studied law and political science. And I came to this country with my backpack on vacation. And I loved it. So I decided to stay.
Okay, Jean-Pierre, give us a little taste of your early life.
Well, I was born in East part of France. I'm in a beautiful region called Franche-Comté, which is a different county like the Jura, and so on. My father was an agronomist, so we moved quite a bit during my childhood. So we moved from the east part of France to Normandy, and from Normandy to the southwest of France. From there, I went to hotel school in Toulouse for 3 years, did some internship in France and Germany, and worked there for a couple of years. Then moved to America, to United States, for like Denise was saying, with a backpack and for to see some new things. And I spent 2 years in Washington D.C. Working in kitchens, restaurants, and then I moved to California. I ended up in Berkeley first. I started to look for a job because I, you know, was running low on money. So, and that's how I ended up at the door of Chez Panisse asking for a job. And I had an interview with Jeremiah Tower and Alice Water for an hour, and they took me for a trial period of time for 2 weeks, and 35 years later, I was still there working at the restaurant.
It's such an incredible story. So the two of you have these deeply rooted French experiences where you grow up very familiar with the land, very familiar with the making of food, and then you end up meeting one another. Was it literally on the sidewalk outside of Chez Panisse?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We knew about each other for a year because we had common friends in our wine business, food business, and they wanted us to meet. And we always said, told them the same story. I mean, just we don't want to, you know. For me, I didn't want to meet a French girl, and for Denise, it was the same thing. So it was way back in the 70s. I mean, we had a little herb garden in front of the restaurant, and I was attending the herb garden, and a common friend just stopped by and introduced Denise to me, and then, you know, as you say, we got married 6 months later.
Denise, do you remember the first meal you made for Jean-Pierre?
Yeah, because I was bringing, I had an aunt who was making confit and force-feeding ducks. And she made delicious pâté and delicious confit. And each time I came back from France, I had some in my suitcase. But I thought, who is going to appreciate that here? They don't know about this kind of food. So when I invited Jean-Pierre, I thought, him, he's going to appreciate. And he did. He loved it. Yeah.
I'm so curious about the way you grew up in boarding school. And you talk a bit in the book about how your life was pretty regimented in France. So tell me a little bit about that kind of discipline and then being thrown into Berkeley of the 1970s.
Oh, my God. Freedom. I mean, you could dress the way you wanted. You could speak to anybody. You know, in France, the society is very hierarchical, if I can. I mean, you usually navigate always in the same social class, which I don't like. I like to meet people from all kind of walks of life. And I got that because I lived in Berkeley and I had these opportunities. So it was very freeing for me.
Jean-Pierre, you came to Chez Panisse at a really interesting time. It was still kind of the wild years when Jeremiah Tower was running the kitchen. But the restaurant was no longer a baby, but it wasn't quite an adult yet either. You had all this traditional French training. I would imagine that you, coming into that kitchen, it wasn't the most disciplined place.
As you can, you're absolutely right. It was not. And I was shocked, but I was also really pleased. 75 was, I think, the turning point, 75, 76 of the restaurant. As you said, it was the start of something, being with Jeremiah Tower, I think he's the one who just started to try something different in terms of food. And that was, I think, for me, the most exciting time of Chez Panisse. I mean, the golden years, because not only it was really creative, it was really happening. It was the Chez Panisse was not famous like it is today yet. And as you say, it was wild in the kitchen. I mean, I don't think I can, you know, I'm not going to tell you all the thing we did, but we had fun. I learned a lot. And it was really a lot of work too. I mean, it was really intense. But for me, those years, again, they were extraordinary. I mean, they were beautiful. Even if I, you know, was working then, like now, I mean, 10, 12, 12, 14 hours a day, I mean, it was really worth it.
I would love for each of you to share a dish with us from the book that's pure you. So first, Denise, I want a recipe that is you, that comes from your background, something you love to cook, you love to share with people.
What comes to mind is a floating island, because I grew up, when I grew up, we had a cow, we had fresh milk every day, and we needed to use that milk. So my mother did a lot of dessert. And that is a very, it looks good. It is a dessert which look fancy, but it is not very complicated. So I make often floating island, and my daughters love them.
And now, Jean-Pierre, something from you.
Well, it's not a specialty, but again, it's the cassoulet. It's a really regional dish. You can even do it here. I mean, with all the ingredients. I mean, the beans, the confit, the lamb, the sausage, and it's a delicious winter thing. I mean, I think in the book I have a long recipe for it, but also I have a recipe with shortcuts that you can buy the sausage, you can buy the confit, you can buy the beans. You cook them, so you just have to put everything together and bake that for, you know, 2 or 3 hours in a low oven, which is delicious dish for the winter.
Thank you so much, the two of you. It's been lovely having you with us.
Thank you for asking us. It is wonderful, and I hope we meet you someday.
Thank you so much.
That was Jean-Pierre Moulet and Denise Lurton-Moulet. Their book is French Roots, Two Cooks, Two Countries, and the Beautiful Food Along the Way. We've got Denise's recipe for floating islands on the Good Food blog. You have two opportunities to taste Jean-Pierre and Denise's food later this month. They'll be at Luke on Sunday, October 26th, and at Cooks County on Wednesday, October 29th. Both dinners will feature a set menu inspired by the book. Plus, the authors will be on site to sign copies. We've got all the details on our website. And now, why don't we head over to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to catch up with Laura Avery. She's there now to highlight some seasonal ingredients that you can only get right now in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with CJ Jacobson, who's the executive chef of Girasol Restaurant in Studio City. CJ is that tall guy you see roaming around the market, head and shoulders above everybody. And CJ is here today. We have a seasonal specialty that you have already discovered and want to talk about today. So tell us about what you found and what you're going to do with it.
I have freshly picked pistachios. So like a lot of nuts, they have sort of like a fruit on the outside, and or skin or whatever you want to call it. I call it fruit. They're really only around this week, which makes them special to me. And what's great is I use the skin and the insides. Go ahead.
The skin is pink, and when you drive around up there and you're always looking at the trees, and if you see those beautiful pale pink clusters, those are the pistachios.
Yes, they're not like rose fruit or anything. They are pistachios. And what we do is I'll take the skins off and I'll kind of quickly blanch them. It takes away some of their bitterness. It's like leaching, I guess you could call it. We do it with a lot of wild stuff. And then I'll chop them up and kind of make like almost like a chimichurri with it for the sauce and incorporate the pistachios some other way. The pistachios themselves are, they're not firm like the ones you get dry roasted.
And then what do you do with the raw pistachios?
I love like raw nuts and things like this. I think they have an entirely different flavor, just like you'd approach raw fruit and unripe fruit in different ways. You know, they both have different sort of ways you can use them. I do the same thing with the nuts. Like I have more raw nuts on my menu than roasted nuts, so they will go on probably a fish dish, maybe even a pumpkin dish. We'll see.
I know that a lot of the Persians who really go nuts for these raw pistachios, I didn't mean to say that. Will put them in cooked like rice dishes, these beautiful raw pistachios, just toss right in there.
I did get some of Kenter Canyon's farro, so we'll see. It might make an appearance.
Might make a great salad.
That might be it. Thank you very much for that. I'm going to use that.
All right. And is there any way to preserve these? I know they're only in season for a week. Is there anything that you can keep the husks around longer?
I'm considering it. Like, the box is fairly cheap considering how expensive pistachios usually are. It'll be a lot of labor, but I'm definitely going to kind of blanch them, just cryovac them and put them in my freezer and see how they work.
All right. Well, great. Well, this is a great way to celebrate this super rare seasonal specialty. So thank you so much, CJ.
Thank you.
That was CJ Jacobson. He's the executive chef at Girasol in Studio City, teaching us a whole new way to look at the green pistachios, which are only in the market for a week. We're now talking with Boomer, who is the salesman for Santa Barbara Pistachios. He's been with the company for over 10 years. The fresh pistachios are such a short season crop. The majority of your crop is dried and then flavored and seasoned that you sell all year. Can you explain the process where the fresh pistachio becomes the dried flavored one?
Yeah, when the pistachio first comes off the tree, it has a soft coat over the hard coat that needs to be removed a week to 10 days because there's so much moisture in the nut that it'll stain and mold the nut. And so that's why we only have the green nuts, they're called, for such a short period, like 1 week a year.
And they're only $2.50 a pound.
$2.50 a pound right off the tree. They haven't been cleaned. We did have a few bags that we've totally cleaned out and took the premature ones out and the twigs and leaves, and those are a little bit more. It's a lot of work. But for the most part, we're so busy, we just bring them right off the tree fresh and $2.50 a pound.
Right, and you said they'll stay good to eat just like this for up to a week.
Yeah, you got to remove the outer husk. Like I said, it's full of moisture. But once you remove that, the raw pistachios, you keep them air sealed in the fridge and they'll last a lot longer.
Yeah. And CJ was telling us he did something with the husk. He's going to make a chimichurri. Tell us what other uses there are for those husks.
Well, a lot of people in the Middle East will take the husks and they'll add water and boil them and then drain the water, do that process three times, add a little sugar, and you have a jelly, a paste, which is real popular in the Middle East.
That would be such an amazing experiment to try. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever done it?
I have not done that, but it's not done a lot over here. I really like our flavored ones. I've had the raw ones a lot, and it is great because you only get it 1 week a year, and a lot of people like it, but I'm a flavor kind of guy.
Yeah, and you got such a great selection that it's easy to go from one to the next. Yeah,
10 different flavors.
Yep. And then, so the process at Santa Barbara Pistachio is they will take now all the rest of these green nuts. How do they then make them crunchy?
They remove the outer husk, and then we store them in cold, dry storage as long as they need. And then they take those out and they brine them as they need them.
So then are they air dried at some point? And how does that take place?
Now what we do when we roast them, we dry roast. We don't use fire. We blow air through them. You don't want to destroy the enzymes and stuff. If you overheat them, you can really destroy the nut. And so the key is to just be very fragile with them and keep them as fresh as possible when we flavor them.
And the other products are the meal and the oil.
Yeah, the oil is what we're most proud of everything on the table, because nobody presses that oil. It takes 10 pounds of pistachios to press one little bottle of oil. And so we have a meal that's the byproduct of pressing the oil, which is mostly used as a rub on fish and chicken. You can also put it in your smoothies, oatmeal, pancake batter. I love it in ice cream. But you can really put it in anything. You can eat it straight up. But they are rare products that you don't find anywhere because nobody presses that oil. Most people can sell all their pistachios. These are the highest quality pistachios, and we don't sell our seconds. We actually press the oil with them. These are the highest quality pistachios, and we want to keep it that way. And we think the oil in the meal is a great addition to the table.
It is. It's just such a wonderful line, and everything has always been so tasty and delicious. So we appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. You guys have a great day.
You too. That was Boomer. He is the salesman over here for Santa Barbara Pistachios, and this is the 1 week of the year when you can get the green pistachios. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We've got photos of the raw pistachios on the Good Food blog. Every Friday, we always post what you should be shopping for this weekend. We call it the Good Food Market Digest. So check it out before you head out for your weekend shopping. a minute. A trip to Portugal and some really good sushi. That's next.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. If you peek inside the new cookbook, My Portugal, by Chef George Mendez, it's pretty clear that it's going to be a very personal cookbook. It begins with a dedication to his family and a beautiful photograph of a poem by his grandfather that's actually incised into one of the walls of their ancestral town. As you turn the pages, family photos and memories are sprinkled amidst shots of perfectly beautiful styled plates of food from his restaurant, Aldeia, in New York City. Aldeia actually means village in Portuguese, and while the food's more global than village-like, it's pretty clear where his heart lies. Hi, George.
Hello.
One of the hallmarks of Portugal is that it's so tiny. Actually, land and sea is like right next to each other.
Yes, totally.
So the food of the part where your people came from, what were some of the most sort of emblematic dishes that you remember the most?
Gee, I grew up to my mother making a variety of rice dishes, tomato rice, so rabbit rice, and there was a lot of preparations using collard greens. I grew up with a garden along the driveway, no matter how small our property was. So there were tomatoes, parsley, collard greens. So, you know, I think when my parents immigrated back in 1969, they brought with them dishes like rice, various pork preparations, you know, simple pork fillets from the loin that were grilled over charcoal with green peppers. Sardines were huge. There was always sardines in the refrigerator, whether they were frozen, you know, imported from Portugal, which were my mom's swear till this day are the best ones. You know, there was suckling pig. There was so many different soups that I grew up with as a child that my folks brought from that area of Portugal.
And you grew up in Danbury, Connecticut. Was it like a village of people from home?
Totally, totally. It was a very tight-knit Portuguese community with my family and then my aunts and uncles that also came from the small village of Freiras do Dão. We had a Portuguese food store called Fernandes Food Market. We had the Portuguese club where there were bands playing on Friday and Saturday nights and then on Sundays celebrating various saints' days. You know, and everything was – all of us lived on this same street. So it's like you'd walk to the right, it was my uncle's house. And then next to him was my other uncle's house. Then it was my aunt's house. And then we had this big community of other Portuguese families that, you know, my parents were friends with. And, you know, I would go to school with their kids. So it was definitely a tight-knit community.
And you grew up in a family where people made things. I mean, made sausage, made wine, right?
Yeah. I still remember the days of my father had a concrete vat in the basement of one of our homes in Danbury. And I still can remember vividly till this day being in there in underwear squashing grapes with my feet with my cousins. And yeah, we'd make our own wine. And then my uncle, who lived two houses down, would be making his own sausages, linguiça and chorizo, and they'd be smoked in his barn over garage out in the back.
So let's get back into the nitty-gritty of Portuguese cuisine, which to me is salt cod, kind of.
Yes.
Underlies everything, right?
Yes, totally.
You know, it's so interesting because I look at that part of the Mediterranean and I feel like, okay, we understand what Spanish food is and we understand what French food is and we understand what Moroccan food is. And here's this little country, Portugal. It shares so many things with all those other cuisines, and yet it's set apart. And I feel like one of the things that sets it apart is this flavor profile of salt cod.
Right. You know, salt cod kind of, as you know, going backwards for a second, as a kid, I hated it, to be honest with you. It was a smelly, dried piece of fish sitting in the garage in water. And I think it got a bad rap. And I think till this day, many Americans or many people think that it's a salty piece of smelly fish. And really what it is something that went through a fermentation process, just like beer does, just like wine, just like champagne does, just like other, you know, dried fish. And what happens there is you have this piece of very bland white flesh fish, and that's what I'm talking about in its raw state, pulled out of the ocean. Cod itself is very bland, and you know, and it took fishermen, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and you know, it was a method of preservation. And when you added the salt and dried it, it took on a very meaty quality. And then when treated right and you soak it in water for 3 days and changing the water all the time, you end up with a nice, salty, briny piece of fish. And the longer you soak it in water, the more mellow it becomes. So now it's taken on a very dense, meatier texture. And I think that's where the pleasure comes in. If you treat it right and you soak it long enough, it's no longer salty. And what you're left with is this very, you know, condensed piece of fish that has a little bit more bite and a lot of flavor to it.
And you actually take fresh cod and you make your own salted cod.
That's correct. We, till this day at Aldea, we bring in state cod. Each fish weighs about anywhere between 12 to 15 pounds. The head is already off, and we take it, we fillet it, we pull all the bones out, and we basically weigh the flesh, and we take 25% of its weight in salt, kosher salt, and we coat it, and it'll sit in this crust of salt, both sides, for at least 24 hours. And then from there, if we want to use it immediately, we'll skip a drying process and then just soak it for 3 days, or we'll dry it up to a week. We started doing that at Aldea, and till this day we still do it. And there's like 2 to 3 recipes all the time on the menu that use the salt cod that we cure ourselves.
What are they?
Oh, right now we're doing a Knollcrest Farm egg. It's a Pennsylvania egg that we cut the top off of perfectly using a little egg cutter that we behind, it comes from France actually, and we scramble the eggs with flakes of salt cod, dried black olives, and crispy potatoes and parsley, and that recipe is in the book. That has been done since day one. So it's a take on a classical Portuguese recipe called bacalhau à Brás. Then we also make the gratin, or the casserole of layers of salt cod with potato and melted onions and parsley and black olive that we cook in a cast iron pot. That's a take on another Portuguese recipe called bacalhau a Gomes de Sá. There's always 3 to 4 different renditions of the cod. Then we have tasting menus that also include it in one form or another. So it's definitely a bacalhau-centrified restaurant.
I have to say, the photograph of the cast iron cooked layered dish, I think that's probably going to be the first thing I make.
It's fantastic. I would definitely push you to make it at home. It's a lot of fun to do. It's easily done the day before. It holds really well in your refrigerator. It's a very soulful, very authentic, very real, true dish that is just so satisfying because of all the layers. And when you cook it in the oven with that tight-fitting lid and the cast iron, there's something that happens. It's very magical in that pot. So, I mean, I can talk about that recipe forever. It's really dear to my heart. And damn delicious, I will say. Yeah.
Thank you so much, George. It's been really a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Chef George Mendez of Aldea, New York City. His book is My Portugal, Recipes and Stories. We've got a recipe for his salt cod, potato, and egg casserole on our blog. Here to take us on yet another food adventure is Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic for the LA Times, and each week we look forward to his visit here on Good Food. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you?
It's great to see you here.
Great to be here.
Where are we going?
We are going to Sauterelle, and we are going to the newest outpost of the growing Tsuchita Empire.
Okay, so we've heard about Tsuchita in the context of noodles.
Right. There's the original Tsuchita, which serves ramen only at lunchtime, but it's the best ramen in Los Angeles, at least. There's the Annex across street, which serves its own kind of ramen in a particularly rich broth that is copiously flavored with back fat. And in a completely different twist, there's now Tsuchita Sushi just up the street.
Wow. Okay. So given their their execution of what they do, it must be pretty great sushi.
From the day it opened, it was definitely, I guess you'd call it a top five sushi bar in LA.
Top five in price as well?
It's breathtakingly expensive, yes.
Okay, so take us through what you experienced.
The restaurant is in more or less the Edo Mai style, like 19th century almost. Rolls are extraordinarily infrequent. I can't remember actually having one. The fish is almost all, you know, salted or pickled or preserved or sort of laid down with kombu in a way to preserve it, so that there are different sort of like depths to flavor that you'd expect from just a piece of raw fish on rice. To begin with, there's a few courses of, I guess you'd call it a sashimi-like thing. So there'll be like a bowl that has gold leaf on the inside with steamed Japanese abalone and a little bit of steamed spinach and a few dots of yuzu zest, yuzu being the really fragrant Japanese citrus. And the abalone is a little funky and the spinach is a little bit sharp, but somehow it all comes together and it's sort of a beautiful composition. Super simple, almost nothing to it, but with top-notch ingredients. It sort of like shows you where he's going from there.
So are they the tiny little abalone?
This one was a pretty big abalone. They also, actually in the very next course, you get baby abalone that's skewered with this tamago, this kind of fluffy omelet made with sea urchin.
Wow. So the sea urchin is whipped into the egg?
Yeah. And it's baked. And I said a fluffy omelet, but that's actually wrong. It's more pound cake in texture.
Dense and light at the same time.
Right. And with a sort of haunting sea urchin aftertaste, but nothing too powerful. That same course has like a little thing of slivered raw squid. You don't often get squid raw, which is sort of piled into a hollowed out yuzu. And the most interesting garnish of all, which is rice still on its stalk that has been plunged into hot oil, and the rice pops like popcorn.
Still on the stalk.
Still on the stalk. The last time I was there, matsutake season had just begun. Matsutake being the incredibly fragrant mushroom that sort of signals fall. And what they do with matsutake is they make like a tea in a teapot with matsutake and a little bit of seafood. And you pour it out into a little saucer and you squeeze maybe a drop or two of citrus in it. And then you just smell it. And it smells like sort of forest floor and like slight smokiness as if there's a fire in the background and a tiny hint of seaweed and maybe almost, I'm totally imagining this, but almost that little sulfury thing of fireworks far in the distance. It's spectacular. You can just smell it. You don't even have to drink it. Then you drink it and it's really good, but the odor of it, the experience of it comes, I think, in like sort of inhaling its fragrance.
That might be as close as many of we Southern Californians get to a real crisp fall winter experience.
It's true. The smoke in the distance, that we get.
That's true. So does that kind of end this arc of the initial dishes?
It does. And then there's sort of this parade of sushi, different kinds of, say, there's something called kue, which is like a Japanese grouper. I looked it up on several different reference books, and nobody was quite sure how to translate it. But there was like yuzu and a little salt on it. There was sanma, which you usually have grilled, but this was raw, and it was wrapped with a slab of the matsutake mushroom. The one thing I tasted that I had never had before that apparently is a total rarity even in Japan was this kind of cracker made out of sea cucumber roe.
Sea cucumber roe.
Right. There aren't many eggs in a sea cucumber, so it usually takes 15 or 20 sea cucumbers to come up with enough roe for the dish. And then you take the sacks, which are in strips, you sort of like layer them, and it looks like a nacho cheese Dorito. It's about that size and about that color. And they toast it and bring out the fragrance of it. And they put a few grains of caviar. And it's funky, but it's briny. And there's this sort of like wonderful sort of like low tide fragrance to it. A chip made out of sea cucumber. I mean, who would have thought that that would be something that you would crave?
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Jonathan Goltz, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about sushi Tsujita on Sawtelle. Get a text with the restaurant's name, address, and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting GOODFOOD to 69866. Plus, find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on Good Food's restaurant map. It's on the Good Food blog. Coming up, is it possible to fat shame a man? We'll dive into the gender politics of weight and body image next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. In May of this year, we dipped a toe into fat shaming on this show, mostly about how it affects women. We spoke to one journalist on that show about whether or not it's even possible to fat shame a man. After the show aired, we did hear from some of our male listeners who said, yes, it is possible and it does happen. So we were curious to learn more. We reached out to Dr. Allison Field, who studies the effect of body pressures on boys and men. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So some people do say that men can't be fat shamed, that it's okay for men to be fat in a way that it's not okay for a woman. Do you think that that's true?
There is slightly more acceptance of heavier men in society, but there is tremendous pressure on young men to have an ideal physique. Any magazine you pick up has an image of a very, you know, muscular male or sculpted male. And those physiques are equally impossible for men to achieve as the images young women are seeing.
So are young men actually trying to gain weight to look like those images?
That's a really good point. They're not trying to lose weight necessarily the way that women are. They tend to want to have bigger or more defined muscles. So that may mean gaining weight, but it's not necessarily gaining weight overall. It's really a focus on muscles and definition.
So how widespread is this?
We find in our data it's quite widespread. What's interesting is that a lot of girls also are very concerned with their physique and how toned and defined their bodies are. So many of the studies out there have focused on thinness, and that's why everyone thinks this is just a problem for girls. But in our society now, where every People magazine or Us or any other magazine you pick up has all the young stars and shows how muscular they are, how they've changed weight or their muscle definition for a certain role, and that's true for women and men. We have huge pressure on how we look these days.
So are boys more likely to be depressed and to binge drink or to take drugs?
We definitely find that in our data. We find that these young men who are very concerned with their muscles and wanting more toned and defined muscles, and they're concerned enough that they start using products to increase the size and the strength of their muscles, so that some of those may potentially not be unhealthy, such as creatine, and others clearly are, like steroids. We find these males are more likely to start binge drinking frequently, and they're more likely to start using drugs.
Does this kind of behavior end up spilling over into eating disorders?
Well, I would argue that we probably should consider this an eating disorder. Right now, the diagnostic criteria were made by clinicians who mainly see female patients. And so the criteria may not fit males quite as well. And I think not only are eating disorders somewhat less common among males, but we miss a lot of them. So if females are so focused on their weight and evaluate themselves on their weight and will do very unhealthy things to achieve their ideal weight, which is very thin, than males who are very concerned with their physique, so concerned this is how they identify, that who they are is really how they look in the mirror, and will do unhealthy things. That is equally unhealthy, and that should also be considered an eating disorder. It is not at present.
So tell me what some solutions are that you would really love to see.
Well, I think it's very important that we talk to young people in general about why they want to change their weight or shape. If they're trying to become healthier, then let's help them to adopt more modest strategies that they can stick with in the long term. We know what tends to happen, particularly in females, is that they will adopt a diet that's a very big change from what they're currently eating, and it's very hard to stick with. And so what people will do is they'll go on this extreme diet, and it's impossible to stick with. They go off, and then they may overeat or binge eat, and they tend to then gain weight over time. So we know that's not healthy. We need to help people to have really more appropriate goals and to understand the images that are so widespread that we're all confronted with every day. Those images have been heavily touched up. There is a lot of shading that goes on and sculpting. So even the models and the actors who do this professionally, they can't look as good as the people in those pictures. So there is no way that anybody else should think that they could possibly achieve those physiques. And we need to make it clear to young people, these are not appropriate role models for them to have.
So in your research practice, are you continuing to look at different examples of the males in our society and this issue of weight?
Absolutely. I'm very interested in what presentations look like, how different they might be in terms of males and females and at different ages. And I'm also very interested in figuring out when is the tipping point with anorexia that someone really, they're losing too much weight and they have sort of the early stage of anorexia. Can we figure out what that is so we could intervene earlier?
Thank you so much, Doctor. Very interesting conversation.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Allison Field. She is a Harvard medical professor, and she studies issues of weight as they affect men. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen whenever you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's smartphone app. Thanks to everybody who made today's show possible. That would be Jillian, Laryl, Caroline, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleinman. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.